Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with David Benn. He's the artistic director for Magicana here in Toronto. And it's an organization you're going to want to learn a little bit more about. What we really got together to talk about was his fundraising drive that he's about to go on. It's kind of crazy. It's kind of fun. He's going to shave his head of hair. For those of you who know me, that's pretty meaningless. But in David's case, it kind of means a great deal. But he's hoping to raise about $250,000 for cancer research. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. We talk about difficult things and why they're the best things, according to David. We talk about why he's been obsessed with magic for 40 years and why secrets are so important. We get into mentorship and we get into what it means to be a student and why a magician's not an actor playing the part of a magician. That's kind of interesting. We talk about wonder and exploration and why David is fascinated by paradox. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. There's a lot going on. There's so many metaphors. And we even talk a little bit about the new Star Wars film and what it means to be a Jedi. So, I mean, come on. That's reason alone for listening to the interview. So buckle up. DavidPeckLive.com, Rabble.ca for more podcasts coming soon to a digital device near you. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest and an old friend of mine, David Benn, who is the artistic director of Magicana. He's just come off a couple of weeks at the Soul Pepper Theatre in Toronto and about to step into quite a fundraising campaign. I'm looking at quite a mop of head of hair here, David, that's soon to disappear.
That's right. Princess Margaret Hospital's No Hair Selfie campaign, where a bunch of us are trying to raise awareness for cancer research by agreeing to shave our head completely bald. This will be timed with World Cancer Day on February 4th, and it's now gone global with other programs in South Africa, in Israel, I believe in South America, and it was all spearheaded last year out of Princess Margaret Hospital. And I suggest you go to nohairselfie.com and download the app, because I believe it does some wonderful things to help you simulate what you'd look like without hair.
I don't have a problem with that.
You don't. But in my case, I've had this sort of, I suppose it's a signature mop, cultivated perhaps through osmosis. And it's a great cause, having been touched by cancer. They say 1 in 3 have been touched by cancer. But in my case, I lost my sister-in-law 16 years ago, my wife 2.5 years ago, and my niece this summer.
Wow.
So,
holy cow.
Yeah, and that's tip of the iceberg. There are many other friends, but there are also good cancer stories. You know, we have friends, Suli, who works with us, has been, you know, past remission for years and years and years, and Daniel Zuckerbrot has beat cancer, knock on wood, and so there are success stories. But it's interesting, the whole cancer fundraising, you know, issue and how incremental the research is sort of ties in with how I feel magic is learned, that if you're going to do difficult things, which are the best things, I think, you have a lot of failure. So you have to be able to embrace failure and not let it get you down. And I imagine it's the very same thing for cancer researchers, where there's a lot of failure. But if you keep at it, I believe, like, you can perform miracles with magic. You can do it with cancer.
There's discovery in failure, is there not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So you're a magician. You're a writer, you're a director, producer, you've kind of done it all.
Someone who can't hold down a real job, as they say.
That's right. We're sitting in a library here, several thousand books and journals about the art of magic.
Yeah.
You've just come off this show. You're playing with a pack of cards as I interview you. What's in it for you? Why magic? I mean, I think it's a pretty simple question, and yet I think ultimately quite profound in your case.
Well, I was sort of muttering earlier that don't be surprised if I have no answers, because right. The more that I have done this now, and it's kind of it's sad to think that I've now been doing magic, kind of obsessed with magic, for 40 years. Like, you hit the big 40, and that's not an age, because I'm 54 now, 55 in March, but 40 years obsessed with this subject, and it hasn't abated in any way, shape, or form at any particular point. And I've said many times that I believe some people think musically. I believe some people think in terms of language. I believe that some people maybe think in terms of numbers. And I just think in terms of magic, which means that my brain has always explored the idea or been fascinated by paradox. And how can I purportedly resolve that paradox? And that's just the way my brain is wired. And it's taken me many, many years to both realize that and not so much embrace that as being, I guess it's realize that, and then phase two is not be ashamed by that, and then phase three is embrace that.
Why is that sad? You mentioned earlier, or is...
Well, I guess it's just being playful in words. I mean, it's just... Who knows? I don't...
Sad that you've missed out on something else?
No, or
that
I you haven't didn't, really missed on anything else.
But that you didn't that. Go to the... Like, spend your time in the laboratory? Is that kind of what you mean?
No,
like,
maybe I don't know. I should no, have no. I'm just, I'm being more, I'd say ironic, except I'm not sure of the meaning of that.
Neither am I right now. So, small eye.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, I don't know. I just... I've been very... focus, but it's not by design, it's by nature. So I don't have any regrets on it.
So by nature, interesting to me. So you've studied under Ross Bertram, a famous Canadian magician, a writer, yes. And so on, and spent a lot of time sort of under his tutelage of a sort, alongside, you say, by design. So where does somebody like Ross, a teacher, a master, the apprentice, the whole...
Well, I
fit in.
I think there's a big difference between what obviously the public perceives as magic and how you learn magic and what's involved with magic, where you go to used to be magic shops, or you get a book in the library, or you now go to the internet. And really that has absolutely nothing to do with the sort of magic that I know, love, and explore. And then there's a school of people who say that magic is based on this sort of phrase attributed to this great French magician, Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin, that said the magician is really an actor playing the part of the magician. Well, I don't think that's true either. I think that magic is its own genre, its own media. Like, it's a separate art. It's a craft that can be, I say, an art in the hands of an artist. But I think it has its own sort of aesthetic and skill set requirements that differentiate it between acting and all these other disciplines. And I think that to really study it and to really develop a proficiency with it and to become... to use it as an outlet for really creativity, you require a different set of skill set than just being an actor or memorizing a skit. And to me, it has more of a, if I had to draw a parallel to anywhere, it'd be a cross between music and dance. I think it has much more in common with developing the ability on a fine instrument. It's, violin, piano, or any instrument that you want to take to that level. And so what that means for me with my training is I had kind of the, if I had to put it in a parallel universe, I started working out at a music shop, but it was actually a magic shop. And that's where, instead of being Long and McQuaid, it was Morrissey Magic. And people would come in and I would, sell them sheet music and, simple ukuleles, type of thing. But I had great exposure to that. I was constantly you know, exposed to that. And then I was sort of, I've had many mentors. You know, people are fortunate if they have like one mentor in their life. And I've had at least four, and I could be charitable and probably say six different mentors in different fields over the course of my life. So yes, Ross was instrumental, but he was just one of them. Right? And so, but then from the magic shop, I was my relationship with Ross Bertram, who I describe as one of the virtuoso sleight of hand artists of the 20th century. It was like studying with, you know, Glenn Gould, right? And so, with his own reclusive period, his the virtuoso technique, the understanding of all aspects of different branches of it, just that total life obsession. And so I studied with Ross for, it's hard to say because it was never a defined thing. I asked him to take me on as a student, and he said he didn't take students, but he would answer all the questions that I had. And every weekend for 4 years, for 4 or 5 hours at a time, then morphed when I moved away to law school, I would commute back on weekends, and then it sort of drifted when I went to England. So then we got like a 6 year span. Right?
What I hear there is this. I mean, I hear a lot of stuff there, David, but I hear a serious, passionate commitment to the cause, to the relationship. Was it to the relationship? Yeah, but the commitment to me is essential.
Well, commitment
essential.
Is important, but it's essential. But I'm not sure it's to any cause. It's like somebody asked me, it was on Q. And they said, well, you're no one for trying to elevate magic into an art form, and you want to elevate it into an art. I'm not interested in that at all. Right? And I'm interested in my work. I'm interested in the exploration of ideas and things that the way that my head works. And I'm not interested to raise magic in the eyes of the audience or the magic community. Even though, you know, Magic Anna, we formed this organization to study the performance and advancement of magic as a performing art. But that's not, and I guess there's a public element to that, but it's not really.
It's an unexpected outcome?
It's an unexpected outcome. It's an unexpected outcome. So.
So you're in this for yourself, in a sense, as an artist. As a thinker, guy fascinated by paradox, and yet you've just walked off, 22 shows?
Yes. Yeah, but I think that's how...
For sold-out crowds. Sorry? Lots of people saw it.
Yeah, so, which is great. But you know, I guess the key is, and this is, you know, you've known me a long, long time, and people have always asked me, you know, over the years, I get asked, well, what do you do? It used to be, do you do this full time? Then, you know, what do you do?
Well,
how do you feel your day? And Harrison, my son, when he was younger, came up to me one day, and I guess he was in his teens, and he late teens, and he said to me, so, like, what do you do all day? Right? You can hear Harrison saying that.
I can hear that, yeah.
And I said to him, well, I practice. I said, you see me practicing every day? I practice a few hours every day. And he goes, yeah, what else? And I said, well, I write. You see me like writing a lot. And he goes, yeah, what else? He says, well, I do some of the business finances and stuff because I have that background. And he says, and yeah, what else? And I said, I dream. And he looked at me and he said, you dream? And I go, yeah, I just sit here and I just dream. And that conversation was important for me because it made me start to realize that maybe I can use the A word without pretension. And the A word for me is the scariest word in the English language, and that's artist. And I've always been attracted to the arts.
Trying to think of something funny, and I'm sorry, I just couldn't come up with it. The A word.
I know. And I'm afraid to say it. And I was afraid to say that I'm an artist.
Afraid to call yourself an artist.
Afraid to call myself
I remember
an artist.
A book, and it might even have been a book that you recommended to me some 27 years ago. And in it, no kidding, and I can't think of the title, start referring to yourself as an artist today. If you're a poet, you're a poet. Say to your friends, say to your wife, say to your mom, hey, I'm a poet now. Yeah. I'm an actor. I'm a writer. And you're still struggling with that today.
Well, for sure. Now I'm starting to say, because I'm older and I'm saying, you know what, I'll take you on. If you want to really have the fight over it, I don't really care. But I was embarrassed to say it in a way because I had so much respect for so many great artists and so many different disciplines that to even think that I'm connected to them was right. intimidating.
Sure, of right, course. Right. David, do you think, I mean, maybe an insight here of a sort, but do you think that your contribution won't really be seen until down the road? Is that the definition of an artist,
you know,
right?
Perhaps, you know, again, not to refer back to Q, but we sort of touched on this, and I said to them, like, to me, an artist is someone who has an understanding of the past, a superb technique, and a vision for the future. And you need all three. And I'd say I'd like to be, I suppose, considered an artist, but I said it's not for me to judge.
Right.
I mean, and so maybe there is a time. But again, to me, that comes across as, you know, pretentious to say, well, one day they will realize, you know, maybe there is no contribution. You know,
right.
Maybe, and it's really not done for that. It's done for, I guess, I'm going to say personal. It's not even personal growth. It's just like it's in you to do this.
And I get that, and you're fascinated by paradox. I love that line. You dream. You're interested in your work and your ideas. I get all that, and yet, I mean, magic was not meant to be done, it seems to me, in isolation. Isn't it about sharing? Isn't it about a relationship
with
your audience?
Well, you know, I sort of coined the moniker for Magicana, which is sharing wonder. Right, and I believe that's what it's about. And there's a double-edged thing here, though, in the sense that, you know, Luc Sant, I've quoted this many, many times, he wrote this piece for the New York Times magazine supplement, I think it was around 2001 or so. I reference it in the Advantage Playbook. And in fact, I can just pull it off the shelf, or you can reach up behind and just, if you grab the tricks of the Advantage Playbook.
Yep. Yep.
And basically what he's saying here, in fact, you know, it's just this remarkably crazy passage here. So you got Advantage Play there, and I'll pull
nice,
that out.
Nice library.
Oh, there you go. So to me, this was a pivotal thing in the understanding of what it is that I do. And I can just read parts of it. It was the New York Times Magazine, December 3rd, 2000. I said it was dedicated to secrets. And I translate secrets into magic. And Luc Sant wrote this piece, What Secrets Tell. He said, people need secrets because they need the assurance that there is something left to discover, that they have not exhausted the limits of their environment, that a prize might lie in wait like money in the pocket of an old jacket, that the existence of things beyond their ken might propose a corollary that their own minds contained unsuspected corridors. People need uncertainty and security. It's not that secrets make them feel small, but they make the world seem bigger. A major necessity these days, when sensations need to be extreme to register at all. Secrets reawaken that feeling from childhood that the ways of the world were infinitely mysterious, unpredictable, and densely packed, and that someday you might come to know and master them. Secrets purvey affordable glamour, suggest danger without presenting any actual threat. If there were no more secrets, an important motor of life would be stopped and the days would merge into a continuous blur. Secrets hold out the promise, false but necessary, that death will be deferred until their unveiling. And I thought, man, that's why we do what we do.
Beautiful. I mean, but why the hell did you go into magic? Why not become a philosopher? Why not become a scientist or a Catholic priest, for heaven's sakes?
Oh, because I think magic was the root of all of them.
Interesting. So what is that, the discovery part of that?
All of that flows out of magic. I mean, I'm not into the sort of shamanistic roots as much as some of these other people, but there's no doubt about it that, you know, magic, it's interesting. Magic involves power.
It's a beautiful quote, by the way. Page 215, Advantage Play, for those of you out there who want to look it up.
Magic involves power, and yet I've never bothered to exercise power with magic, because you hear a lot of people get into magic because they're compensating for some awkwardness as a youth.
Right, insecurity.
Insecurity,
yep.
Self-confidence. And I never had that. Like, so I didn't have a...
Hey, I knew you when you were young.
Yeah, and I wasn't, and you were younger.
That's true.
But I didn't have those sort of you know, problems to me, where that attracts a lot of people to magic, because all of a sudden they have a secret you don't, and that gives them a sense of sort of power over.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I've always been interested in sort of that concept of sharing wonder and awe. But to get back to that question, I think as I was working on this, the biography of Di Vernon, this I consider the most influential magician of the 20th century, this great Canadian magician, born 1894, died 1992. Vernon, the magic community, a lot of them believe that some of his greatest work was done in the 1960s when he moved out to California and to be a pillar at the Magic Castle, and modern-day contemporary magicians traveled out there to sit at his feet. And I believe his greatest work as a performer, creator of magic, was probably in the 1930s, 40s. And when he was at the castle, he started experimenting with what I'm calling atonal magic. And part of this is interesting. This will come out, I'm sort of tipping a theme in volume two of the book, which I'm now sort of at work on, that the magic community in the sort of latter half of the 20th century took a left turn at Vernon, thinking that the problems he's working on as an older man, which were atonal magic problems, were commercial solutions to problems. And when really he wasn't interested in performing at that point, he was debating on an intellectual plane concepts like Jackson Pollock would do with painting or other areas. And the acolytes there would say, well, no, this is what we need to work on. This is doing, because this is what he's interested on, not understanding that that was really not the motivation or the reason for going for that. So in one sense, I think magic can be sharing wonder. On the other hand, I think it's a great intellectual exercise that can be done as a solitary thing where you don't absolutely need that audience, that it's not always about performance. Eugene Berger, I think, said the Magic Mansion contains many rooms, and I think that's true. So, you know, one of the interesting things for me, and I'm starting to define this more and more, I started developing it years ago, but trying to trace what I say, what school are you from? That there are many schools of magic, and you can't really say one is necessarily better than the other without putting in your own, you know, subjective analysis on it. But it got me thinking, well, there is the sort of Alexander Herman through Keller through Thurston stage school versus the sort of you know, Bamberg approach, which translates into Doug Henning. There's the Vernon East Coast Stars of Magic School, which I came out of with Ross Birchman, people like that, versus the Vernon West Coast School. There's the Spanish School by Tamariz Scania. There's the Japanese School. There's the Chavez School. There's the Marlow Chicago School versus the Chicago Bar Magic School. And I think that from a... So as a performance point, it's helpful to trace, well, where are you out of? You know, there was a line by Picasso that I just wrote down. I found it in one of my old notebooks, which, to paraphrase, said the quality of the artist is dependent upon the amount of the past that he carries with him. And I think that knowing what school you're from is helpful. But there's also that school where you can be that introvert just working on those intellectual problems that have plagued people for centuries. And I look at Vernon and Jay Marshall, the great Dean of American Magicians, who died, well, probably 10 plus years ago. When I asked him about Vernon, he said, Vernon never really invented anything. He just exercised perfect editorial judgment. And I thought that's fantastic, because that's what Vernon did. He would reflect over a problem over the course of 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And if it originally started out with 6 steps, he'd knock it down to 5, and 10 years later down to 4, then down to 3, then down to 2, and then insert a psychological gambit that made it appear self-working. And so I thought the best magic is really just achieved by people spending years of exercising editorial judgment. So now when I look at myself at 40 years and where my work is now, I think a lot of these pieces you may have seen in the show we did at Soul Pepper is a reflection of 20, 30, bordering 40 years of editorial judgment. But you can do that privately. You don't have to do that in performance. You can take an intellectual problem that magicians have been worrying about for 500 years and And there's a room for that. And that's good.
Is there a sense in which that you don't actually know why you do what you do?
Oh, I have no idea.
Like, you know, you're fascinated by paradox. From the quote, the New York Times quote that you just read, you know, this idea of uncertainty. I mean, I've often thought that...
The imagination is just an amazing thing. And you just kindle that imagination and that's enriching in its own life. It's like Stuart James, the great inventor of magic tricks in Courtright, Ontario, where he invented his imaginary friends to talk to. You know, this was Edward de Bono's Six Thinking Hats, you know, years before de Bono was born, allowed him to be an explorer of the subconscious. And Stuart used to say, he said to me, that if you could be a physical explorer like Christopher Columbus, you could go out and you could purportedly discover new worlds. But pretty well all those new worlds are done. And then there are new worlds in the universe, and people explore those. But it was just as rewarding to explore the new worlds in purely of your imagination. And I always loved Stuart's notion that he thought if he could create any animal in existence, he would call it the homing hopper, which would be the cross of a grasshopper and a homing pigeon. So that you would go deep in your self-conscious and you would hop around for different areas, but you could get so lost that you needed the homing pigeon aspect to get out of your own subconscious so that you wouldn't lose your
mind.
Sounds
like a scene from a Charlie Kaufman film, actually.
Right, well, could be.
Do you know, I interviewed a director recently of a documentary film, after getting off the phone in the interview and hitting the tape button at the end of the interview, thinking... not really sure what we got there. I'm not really sure what bubbled to the surface. And yet there's this brilliant film.
Right.
There's this piece that people will enjoy, that people will be challenged by, that people will come back to. They will study.
Well, I think you want everything to work on multiple levels.
And the filmmaker, and my point is, David, the filmmaker didn't really know how he got there. Why he got there. So what compelled you to make this film? Well, I don't know. I just, you know, there were these almost non-answers in a
way.
Well, no,
I have the answer. And I've used it many times. And people generally say, well, why did you do this?
Right.
And the answer is, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Right.
I mean, and it did. And,
yeah,
and
yeah.
Not being afraid, you know, and part of it, you know, it's another, you know, interesting
Not being
quote.
Afraid is great.
And it's, here's the line. The line is, David Bowie was a kind of a big influence on me when I was a kid. I was of that vintage. And years into, you know, that love of that music, I heard Bowie talking about an album, and that he knew it wasn't perfect, but the point is not to achieve perfection on that, just to do it. It's like a snapshot of your body of work at a particular point in time, and then you move on.
And then you move on,
right?
Yeah.
And then I just heard a quote the other day. I was listening to Jazz FM, and they were talking a Da Vinci quote, which I wrote down, which says, art is never finished, just abandoned. And I thought, man, that's absolutely right. That's that snapshot thing. And then the same weekend, Carl Johnson, the writer in New York, was up to hang out. And we were talking about this concept. And this guy who did a biography of Dylan, sort of pressing Dylan on, what was the meaning of, works. And Dylan said, I don't know, it was a record. I got 20 of them. Like, it was just like...
Right.
And so...
Right.
That's
well, and
it.
Maybe we're looking... Maybe now it's time, this idea of recollection. It's time to look back and say,
I can tell you why we did things. I can tell you every little piece and line in the show and where it came out of and what the influence was and what I was thinking about it.
Well, we're talking about authorial intention, really,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure that anyone really does.
Right. In fact, I don't even know what the words were you used. What were they again?
Authorial intention.
Wow.
So, you know, you look at a body of work and you see, so on the surface, maybe it's
except for Erdnase because he needed the money.
Well, I mean, like you say, you what made me think of it was when you said we have our reasons for why we did what we did.
Yeah.
But there's another level. I mean, you want to call it subconscious, you want to call it subsidiary, you want to call it, nuanced or subtle, whatever. There's a whole other level that some of this stuff seems to me to be working on.
Yeah, I guess that's, that's all. That also just brings in the whole notion of the viewer, you know, and what is their role in the process. You know, if, so
What is their role in the process? You know, I'm walking out of the show on Sunday at the Soul Pepper, one of your second or third last performances. Lovely show, by the way. Thank you for that. Listening to the chit-chat and kind of wondering about the effect on
the
audience.
So what is the chit-chat? What is
the... Oh, that was the most fun I've had in a long time. It was a great show. People talking about things that they, you know, that they
think how it's done.
How it's done. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You know, you got the whole problem-solving thing, which has frustrated me for years.
That's interesting, just as a tangent there. Yeah. I've never really worried about that, because I think if they actually think about how it's done, and that they do that during the show, I have failed, because I'm taking them on a journey. Mm-hmm. And it means there was a lapse in the journey that they were not engaged enough to, that they have to worry about how things are done. But afterwards, if they want to reflect on it, it's fair game and it's too late.
Right. Yeah.
That's an interesting one, because a lot of people, that's a current obsession in magic, with fool 'em. And
fool us with Penn and Teller, for all the respect they have. I got some issues with the approach.
I do too. So.
I have a friend who will send me notes and say, David, I've just watched this guy.
Yeah.
I won't quote the name of some magician. Six times over, I keep rewinding it to see how this is done.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I kind of sigh. There's a little bit of sadness at that.
There is for me too. So, but the
so my question is, what do you want that lady, those two ladies who were behind me walking out, who had a lovely time?
Yeah, what I want them to say is that was a lovely time, and then they can get to it. I think what I want them to, go back to Luke Sons.
The uncertainty.
Yeah, that there's something out there we don't know, and how great is that? Makes me want to go into work every day. What don't I know? What can I learn? How will that change?
So I sense there's dissatisfaction may not be the right word, but tension. Is it that childlike sense of wonder that you have not ever lost? So I see it in my kids.
I lost it.
You lost it? Yeah.
Well,
and on one hand, I can go, David, very cynical guy. And on another hand, not at all.
Yeah,
right?
I don't think I'm really cynical. I'm impatient.
Yes.
We didn't have to answer so quickly.
That's right.
I'm impatient. But for other people, I have all the patience in the world.
Yeah, no, it's true.
It depends how it's approached and what the expectations are. So
you lost the childlike sense of wonder.
Well, you know, that's the drug that got everybody into magic initially.
Sure.
You know, and the...
isn't that driving the mathematician? Isn't that driving the scientist? The neurologist that really wants to take it farther?
Right. I mean...
I think.
You know, I think, I suppose if... You know, I've always counseled people not to follow my footsteps. Because I don't wish anyone the level of obsession, because it costs certain sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Right? And then it's like, there was this great magician, T. Nelson Downs, a manipulator, who was approached by the father of Dr. William Elliott, a Harvard educated doctor, circa 1900, who left his medical practice to do basically card tricks. And Elliott's father went up to Downs and said, "You got to talk to my son. You got to say to him, this is not the best path for you." And Down said, "It's too late. Like, once you're bitten by the bug, it's over." Right. And I think that's true.
Is that the nature nurture thing? So if you had been directed, taken by the hand and directed a little bit differently, would you be obsessive about painting, about math, about science?
One of my lifelong ambitions was to be a cocktail lounge pianist, and and actually the flip side of that is to play all the Goldberg variations all the way through. And even though I've played piano like a long, long time, I'm not very good at it. So I just didn't, that wasn't where the primary directive came from. The primary directive for me was, I think magic, and I'm magic in the sense of that's what pulls me. So I don't think so. I think the big change for me was my dad dying when I was relatively young, 17, and I had all these questions, all these what-if questions, and nobody to really ask. And then I ended up meeting some magicians, and I either came across as a good guy, or they were willing to invest in me time-wise. Bob Farmer, Howard Lyons, Herb Morrissey, into Ross Bertram, and I had all these questions. And I think if my father was alive, I would have been under that sort of thumb and that dictum, and I'm not sure the same sense of exploration would have been encouraged. Although, to be fair, he's the one who got me my first magic tricks, right, and the first magic book and those sorts of things. But I'm not sure how that would have veered saying, okay, now you have to make a living. Like, the magic is not something you can seriously do. I'm not sure what his answer would have been to that. Mm-hmm. And that may have changed that direction. But I would love to ultimately, I guess, you know, be a painter or things like that. But I don't have the time to do those in a way, because I practice every day so much, and I think about this, that the last thing I need is another mode for self-expression in that way.
Right.
So,
do you still have a lot of those what-if questions?
No.
Were they what-if questions about magic particularly, or were they about sort of life questions, metaphysical questions?
You know what? I've led a very, I've lost my wife, I've had other issues, but I've led a charmed life. You know, really, I get to do what I love, and I've been able to have a career out of it, like a real career. When I, left law, I was vowed to have a career. That was leaving law 25 years ago, right? And it's funny, they still, the media and other people still gravitate towards us. Was tax lawyer who,
of course,
like that story just will not die.
Of course, why would you leave law?
Right, but it's such a
why would you get into law is a better question, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, there's lots of good reasons to get into law. I think it teaches you a great way of thinking. It teaches you how to collect the debts from all the agents who fail to pay you.
Back to the practicality. Forget the paradox. Let's go practical.
It's all those things. Law was great, and I think it's a great education, and I think it allows you, it gives you the framework to develop an expertise in a variety of areas in a short period of time, which I think is an essential requirement for survival in this day and age.
Where's magic going? I mean, you got it all over YouTube. You got Fool Us. You've got documentaries and books being written about it. It seems like it's become almost a part of popular culture, and yet there's still this layer of secrets out there that exists.
Well, it's interesting that you would say that, because most people argue the alternative, that there are no secrets anymore, where I believe there are lots of secrets. Mm-hmm. And I believe that even though we're surrounded by a few thousand books here.
That's right. The 360 view.
There are only about 6 or 7 books here that I'd keep that actually have real secrets.
Mm.
And we've talked about tacit knowledge before.
Yeah, sure.
And I believe that the they used to say, if you want to keep something secret, put it in print. And now, if you want to keep something secret, put it on the internet. And so it's fine. They're just people who are doing that stuff. They just have like no idea, which is fine. So in a way, not to draw on a Star Wars analogy, but I've always loved Star Wars.
Oh yes, have you seen a new one, by the way?
No, I haven't. But
come on.
No, I've been busy. I was like doing
outrage.
Yes, well, the best is with Harrison again. When they reissued the three, the first three before they did the thing, and I had some tickets to the premiere, and it was in the opening sequence when Darth Vader's walking down the starship, the alley of the starship, and my son Harrison, I guess he had to be, like 6 or 7 at the time, turns to me and whispers in a voice loud enough for the entire theater to hear, "He's really Luke's dad."
Did we see that together?
Oh, were you there with
him? I believe we were. Eglinton?
Yeah, that was at the Eglinton. That was hilarious.
It was hysterical.
Harrison, yeah. He's really Luke's dad. but I believe,
Secrets, folks.
And again, there's only one thing more pretentious in life than professing to be an artist, and that's professing to be a Jedi.
That's probably true. Yes, right? But I want to be both.
I would like to think that you know, there's wisdom in both. I can't disclose the fact that I'm a Jedi of magic, but there are Jedi of magic out there in the world that are preserving the secrets and sharing them to would-be Jedis who sometimes turn to the dark side because they lack the patience required to complete their training. And there are others who will we will see how they transform things.
So I want to kind of wrap up talking more about the fundraiser and sure. some of that side of, sure. of what why we're here today. But tell me about that. What is it? The Padawan Learners.
Right.
Where are the students? Are they knocking on your door? You went to Ross Bertram. You said, "Will you take me on as a student?" Does that happen very often? Is it the kind of thing you even want to happen? Is it necessary? Not only for your health going forward, but for the art and craft of magic itself?
Well, those are a lot of questions,
There counselor. Are a lot of questions, counselor. That's right. None of them asked or answered, yes.
I think that, let me see if I can deal with them. I think that is perhaps still the best way to learn magic and to move it forward is to have the tutelage from someone. The number of people who I think can provide the tutelage, which basically means having the expertise to say, you know what, I don't know that, and maybe you should get the answer somewhere else, are a few and far between. But I think it's ultimately that's the way things that progress and the way things that survive. I've had a few people try to, approach me in a way, and we had, and you participated in a master class, which was my dipping the toe into the concept of teaching more. I think I'm at a point in my life where, again, without hopefully sounding pretentious, I'm just embarking on a really amazing creative period. I've sort of taken off time. I took off time to help my wife raise a family because that was very important to me. My goal was always to be the greatest sleight of hand artist in the world with a stable family. Because it's easy to be the greatest of anything in the world. It just requires total obsession. And so I wanted that balance. Now my kids are grown and they're doing great. And, you know, Jan unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago and we've had to reorganize affairs and things like that. So I'm at that point where I can just now attend to writing projects and other shows and, you know, film things. So, which does not leave a lot of time for teaching. And when I met Ross Bertram, Ross was in his 70s. Right. People kind of, and when Vernon was really helping these guys in California, he was in his 80s. So there comes sort of a point. I think for a lot of people, if you're teaching that early, that's earlier, yes, you communicated information and you answer those questions. You still do that. And Vernon did that. And Ross did that at various points in their life. And I'd like to think I would do the same. And the way you do that is the old, I don't know if it's a Zen saying that when the student's ready, the master will appear, but it's true. And I believe, as I learned from Ross, that you know the student's ready for the information, if not the relationship, by the questions that they ask. Have they struggled with the issues? To be able to flag what the issues. They don't need the answer per se, but they need, you know, the issue. When you walked in here, I was working on this piece, The Vanishing Birdcage, for a year from now. And I've worked on this piece for 25 years.
A show from a year from now.
Yes. And I discovered the correct way to actually handle this. This was never been in print. And I think every single person, including the master, Tommy Wonder, and others, have done it incorrectly.
Wow. And this was a discovery today? Or
no,
just
no. I knew this a few
obviously
years
this
ago.
This is over time.
I can talk to you about it afterwards. Anyway, that's another story. But it took a long time to sort of get to that point. And it was me getting the clue from a master who was living in England, who was unraveling a riddle in his language. That basically what happened is this. He said to me, he was a major collector of somebody by the name of John Martin, who was a secret mechanic for magicians 100 years ago. Roughly 100 years ago. And Martin was the guy who helped really propel, literally and figuratively, this piece forward. And then it turns out that I think everyone out there in the world of magic that I know just doesn't understand actually what Martin did or how it was employed. And this was unraveled through a series of riddles to me. Okay. And so, but...
Michael Polanyi would say subsidiary particulars, just to bring it back to the tacit knowledge. The 40 years, the tutelage, right. The elbow knowledge, all of that just came to bear in an integrated way. And you discovered something...
Yes.
Wonderful.
So nice. Yes, it's exactly
yes,
what happened.
Yes, David, I agree.
So it was asking the questions, and the guy gave me the riddle because I got to the point where I could flag the issue. And that's happened to me a few times in my career. So I think that the way now knowledge is passed on from master to student is that the student will ask questions that flag issues that they understand, that there's this black hole out there, and I spied it around the corner of, you know, just out of view of this, you know, solar system or whatever, and you go, yes, I've seen that. I've spent a lot of time there. Mm-hmm. And then you give them clues on how to get there, and as they make that progress, and most people drop out too soon.
Right.
Right. Mm. And it's that sort of, you know, persistence. Great phrase. You know, that does it. And then they come back. And then finally they come back and they annoy you enough that you say, okay, you work on this and we'll see how it goes. And it works. So.
Well, I mean, it's just, we could keep going, I'm sure. Passion, the commitment, the paradox. I love some of the stuff we chatted about. The uncertainty, being okay with the uncertainty for me is maybe one of my immediate takeaways.
Well, you know what's interesting there is that Uri Geller was in Toronto years ago, and he's a polarizing figure in many worlds. And in fact, a real funny thing for me was I had to interview Geller for his film at the Jewish Film Festival, and a week later was involved with it and seeing the screening of the Randy film. You know, it's
yes,
you know.
And which he appeared in.
Yes,
Uri Geller, Spoonbender, back in the late 70s, early 80s, made a lot of money.
Yeah, perhaps.
Presumably scamming a lot of people.
Perhaps.
Okay. Good.
So Geller's in town promoting his book, and I'm Jan at that time was the head of the Children's Own Museum and was doing a fundraiser for them, and I said, well, let's get Geller to invite him to the banquet. And so we invite him to the banquet, and somebody says, do you think you can get him to perform? And I say, well, you know what, he's a performer, there's 600 people here who might want to buy his book, I bet you he performs. So I say, Uri, would you do something? And he gets up, and I was tipped ahead of time that he's doing this new spoon bending thing. There were, after the spoon bends to whatever is psychic energy or mechanical apparatus you want to attribute it to, he places a spoon down on a lectern and it continues to bend on its own visibly. Mm. Right? And I was aware that this may take place. And I am beside him like a hawk. Like I am watching everything. And so, and he was brilliant because where most magicians would bend 10, 12 spoons in a row to show their power to bend spoons, Geller just bent one. And how does he set it up? He says, became famous for, you know, bending spoons. Ha, 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 ha. I discovered it when I was having matzo ball soup and the matzo ball sort of fell off my spoon because it bent when I was a child. And, you know, great story. Everybody, pick up your spoon. So 600 people pick up their spoon. He's got 600 people engaged in this, right?
Great image, yeah.
And he does the one spoon, and it bends, and he puts it on the lectern, and then we auction it off to raise money. And he says, you know, New York, somebody paid $10,000 for a spoon I bent. And I said, hey, this is like Toronto. We're not going $10,000 here. Somebody paid $2,000 for it and was quite generous because they already owned one of his spoons.
Which is very funny.
You can actually peg who that was, right? Just pure generosity.
Yes.
But afterwards, I'm with Geller, and I was posted on the internet my comments because I described what happened. People say, you believe Geller? No. So I know how I would duplicate that, what he did. Right? But the point of this story is I'm in with Geller outside in the lobby, and this woman comes up to him, and he goes, you are a fake. You are a fraud. I am a real psychic. Mm. Like this. And so that was a kind of interesting twist that the real psychics are saying that he's a fake. Sure. And so Geller turns to me and says, well, what do you think? And I said, you know, Uri, I'm just happy to live in a world where I don't have all the answers.
Nice.
And that remains true to this day.
How long is it going to take you to grow the hair back? Is the fundamental
question.
Well,
Julie, my colleague and the executive director of Magicana, has warned me, you know, sometimes it doesn't grow back.
Oh, that's awesome. That's hysterical.
So, I'm not sure. I've never had my hair like that. So,
and how much are you hoping to raise?
$250,000.
Wow, that's a lofty goal. And you've got, what, a couple weeks?
I have 3 weeks to raise that. I mean, that's kind of crazy, but you know what? I don't look upon failure as defeat. So,
and you said earlier at the beginning of the interview, you said there's a group of you. Is it?
There are many people from different disciplines. Mad Dog, the DJ Warden Al are doing it. You know, for Al, the woman shaving her head. There's people involved with the hospital. Jorn Riesbrot, head of Luminato, is doing it. At the launch, there were 13 of us. There's more, and we're trying to spread the movement. You know, it's sort of its own second of the party ice bucket challenge thing, but who cares?
Right. We're not interested. Anybody can get involved.
Anybody
can
get involved.
I can do this if I want. You can do it.
Absolutely. Go to nohairselfie.com. Okay. Download the app. Spread the word. What they're saying is, shave, share, donate.
Right.
You know,
and what's the overall goal? So you've got $250,000. Is there an overall goal?
Last year they raised, it's the first time they did it, about $1.8 million.
Wow. All for research.
I believe so, yes.
Wow, amazing. Yeah. David, thanks for your time today. Really generous and great conversation. Loved it. David Ben, Artistic Director of Magic Canada. Magic Canna?
Yes.
Whoa. Thanks for that. Thanks again.
Okay. Cheers.